40 greetings to all of our Voice of America listeners. I'm VOA's Andrew Palcheski in Washington, filling in for Sonny Young. Welcome to the Sunny Side of Sports.
Stand up! Stand up! Stand up! Stand up!
Friends, we can all listen to the Sunny Side of Sports.
Yes, my friend.
The Sunny Side of Sports.
Sunny Side of Sports.
The Sunny Side of Sports show.
Great show, bro. This is Sunny Side of Sports.
Sunny Side of Sports right here on the Voice of America.
Voice of America.
Stand up. Stand up. Stand up. Stand up.
We start today's show at the Augusta National Golf Club in the U.S. state of Georgia, where the 81st Masters Tournament got underway early this morning. As golfers battled to take home the green jacket awarded to Masters winners, much of the attention ahead of the tournament was on several big names absent from the Masters this year. First is Tiger Woods, the four-time Masters champion, who withdrew from the tournament last week due to injury. Woods wrote on his website, "I did about everything I could to play, but my back rehabilitation didn't allow me the time to get tournament ready." Second, someone who may or may not play, American Dustin Johnson. The world number one is also suffering from back issues after falling down a flight of stairs and injuring his lower back on Wednesday. Johnson's team says he hopes to recover in time for tee-off today, but it's unclear on whether he'll be able to. But perhaps the biggest name missing from the Masters this year, the great Arnold Palmer, who passed away in September of last year. Palmer had played the Masters 50 consecutive times from 1954 to 2004 and won the tournament four times in 1958, 1960, 1962, and 1964. And in recent years, he had taken part in the ceremonial first tee-off to begin the tournament, befitting his status as a legend of the sport. But although Palmer has passed on, his presence was still felt this morning in Augusta. Prior to that first tee-off, Billy Payne, chairman of the Augusta National Golf Club, placed the Masters green jacket on a white lawn chair next to the tee, in the spot where Palmer watched the first tee-off last year when he was unable to participate due to his poor health. As Palmer's widow Kit sat nearby, Payne said that the almost unbearable sadness we feel at the passing of Arnold Palmer is surpassed only by the love and affection for him, which will forever reside in our hearts. Following a moment of silence, fellow golf legends Gary Player and Jack Nicklaus then continued the tradition in Palmer's absence, teeing off to start the tournament, after which Nicklaus had this to say about his rival and friend. "The Masters did make Arnold in many ways because of his wins," he said, "but in another way, Arnold made the Masters." From Augusta now, we go to Abuja and a sports update from our Sunny Side of Sports contributor, Samson Omale.
We begin the Sunny Side of Sport this evening with a reappointment of Kwesi Appiah as Ghana national football team coach 2 years after he was fired from the same job. Ghana Black Stars has been without a coach since a contract of former coach Avram Grant ended with the 2017 Gabon African Cup of Nations. The Ghana Football Association president Kwesi Nyatasi said Appiah will also take charge of the national team for locally based players and has been offered a 2-year contract to start work on the 1st of May.
Kwesi Appiah was chosen on merit. He was not chosen because he's a Ghanaian. Out of the 95 people who applied, later the 3 people who were interviewed, we thought he was the best. So he won on merit, not because he's our countryman.
Chelsea of England may well have to cope without injured Nigerian star Victor Moses for their crunch big fixture in the English Premier League against Manchester City later tonight. The Super Eagles man has been struggling with a calf injury he sustained in the Blues' FA Cup win over Manchester United in March. Chelsea coach Antonio Conte was not sure the Nigerian star, who has played a vital role in their campaign this season, will be available for selection.
I don't know if it'll be available, but we have another day to check the situation. We have another day for check the situation in the right way. A couple of situations that we have to check and then to make the best decision for the starting 11.
In athletics news, two-time Olympic silver medalist Paul Tergat gained the support of Kenya's most important sports federations on Tuesday in his bid to become head of the country's troubled Olympic Committee. The track and field, soccer and rugby federations announced their support for Tergat, as did six other sports, as Paul Tergat launched his campaign for the presidency of the National Olympic Committee of Kenya.
As a member of the International Olympic Committee, an Olympian, and one who has actively been involved in some of the activities of the Games, I believe I have what it takes to become the president of the National Olympic Committee. And that is why I've decided maybe to stand for this seat, because I believe in one, that there should be an accountability of anything that we do, and transparency.
The election is due for May 5, where he is expected to challenge current Kenyan Olympic head Kipkino.
My first task, obligation and commitment is to ensure that the general interest and welfare of the athletes and all sportspersons in Kenya is fully addressed throughout my tenure. It is my priority to initiate, as a matter of priority, programs that will lead to the diversification and expansion of our participation at the future Olympic Games.
And finally, South African national rugby team, the Springboks, are currently having their second of three scheduled camps in Stellenbosch. Buck coach Alistair Kotze says he is happy to have defensive coach Brendan Venter on board and the experience that he brings.
Two things. We very obviously share the same philosophies about the game. That's the one thing. He wanted to come on board as you know, to work with me. The second thing, I think he can add a lot of value. Experienced coach, he's been working, like I said in the press release, you know, overseas for a long time. He's got really good knowledge of building a sort of defensive structure.
And that's it for the Sony Side of Sports for this midweek. I am Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria.
Thank you very much, Samson, for that report. Well, yesterday on the show, we featured part one of my interview with Giddy Nathan, a tennis writer for Deadspin.com. We talked about everything from Roger Federer's resurgence to the fate of the Big Five in men's tennis. And the reminder, that's Roger Federer, Rafael Nadal, Novak Djokovic, Andy Murray, and Stan Wawrinka, to some of the up-and-comers who could break that dominant hold that those Big Five have had on tennis. Well, today in part two of our interview, it's time to give the ladies their due, starting with some of the biggest stories shaping up on the women's side.
You have Serena Williams out with injury, but up until this year playing really dominant tennis. Her sister Venus playing as well as she has in recent years. You have Maria Sharapova coming back from her suspension for performance-enhancing drugs. Victoria Azarenka, who's left to have a baby, she's going to be coming back. Angelique Kerber is the world number one, trading that back and forth with Serena. All these different storylines on the women's side, what do you think is going to be the dominant storyline this year in women's tennis?
Yeah, I think one thing that's been nice to see on both tours this year is this kind of throwback effect where the Australian Open finals, Roger and Rafa, and then Venus and Serena. So even at 35, 36, you can just never count these athletes out. Even though Serena has to pick her tournaments a little bit more carefully, I think she's as big a threat to win as anyone in any draw. Serena hasn't played since Australia. She unfortunately had to withdraw at Indian Wells with a knee injury, but she'll be back on clay, and I think she'll be playing very well. And I wouldn't be surprised if she added to her slam total this year at all. Venus, meanwhile, had a pretty exciting run in Miami. Became the oldest player ever to beat a world number one, beating Kerber there, and it was just a fantastic match to watch. Both of them just bring so much power and precision to the court that seem to be aging nicely. Venus back in the top 10 now. Serena obviously at number 2. I think they've got plenty of tennis left in them, and if we're lucky, we'll get a matchup between those two, hopefully in a major, as this year goes by.
Yeah, tennis fans have been spoiled, I have to say, so far with Venus and Serena facing off, with Roger and Rafa facing off. Like you said, it's kind of a throwback to old times in tennis. Federer and Serena Williams have won in Australia. I want to kind of look at the year ahead and look at the crystal ball. You talked about Nadal's resurgence, hopefully on the clay court season. Do you think he wins the French Open?
I think he'll be very, very hard to beat there. Based on his recent level of play, like I said, it's so easily forgotten. It gets overshadowed by how even better Roger has been, but he's come back from injury about as well as we ever could have expected. So given how well he played before and how well he's currently playing, I see no reason to count him out. And looking technically at how Roger's made certain twists to his game in terms of timing and speed and flattening out the ball, those things may not work as effectively on clay. And I think maybe that's what went into his calculus to sit out some of the spring clay season. So I think Nadal's going to have a really strong shot at the French Open. Obviously, other players who I'd like to see there, I think Nishikori, a fantastic clay court player, will have a good shot there too if he can get his body right. But he'll be hard to beat. I think if Djokovic can get back on form, he's got to be a major candidate too. But yeah, I think I've finally come back around to the point where I was so blinded by Federer's brilliance. But when you just look on paper, Nadal's had a crazy good season. He's had some really difficult wins. Federer had a tough path through Australia, but Nadal did as well. He beat Zverev in five sets. He beat Dimitrov in five sets, which is one of the best matches of the year. He's playing outstanding tennis. He's doesn't seem to be at a loss for stamina, and that's always been a huge aspect of his game. The one thing I have noticed a little bit occasionally was his forehand, which some have argued is the best shot in the history of the game, doesn't seem to be reaching the same kind of depth in the court. He used to just be able to totally bully people around because he had so much spin that the ball bounces so high and is just really a pain. And historically, it was a pain for Roger on his backhand. But I have noticed a little bit of slipping on Nadal's forehand, but nothing that would suggest that his overall level of play has lapsed. And he'll be one of the favorites in Roland Garros for sure.
On the women's side, we're anticipating the return of Maria Sharapova. She's won titles at Roland Garros twice. Yeah. Is she a big threat going into the women's tournament?
I think so. I think, obviously, there's lots of interesting things about her narrative now with her suspension and how she's been granted wild cards at a lot of tournaments. It looks like she'll be playing in Madrid and Stuttgart on clay. One thing that's easy to forget about Sharapova is her initial breakout wins were on grass in Wimbledon 2004, beating Serena. But as her career has gone on, she's come back from shoulder injuries and had to refashion her game and become one of the most dominant clay court players as well, second only to Serena in winning percentage, I believe. So it's been nice to see the development of that and the adaptation to the new surface, which might now be her preferred surface, clay. So I think she'll be a major candidate to win at French Open as well.
And I won't ask you who's going to win Wimbledon and the U.S. Open because it's too far forward-looking, I think, and there's a lot of injuries that could happen. There's a lot of things that could happen in the season. But I will ask you this one last forward-looking question, a very forward-looking question about 9 months down the road from now. Who on the men's and women's side do you think finishes the year number one?
That's a tough question. I think Federer may not, in part because he'll be picking his tournaments pretty carefully and is probably looking, he's keeping an eye on the majors at this point more than racking up the points in the Masters and the smaller tournaments. Number one could...
Well, let me ask it this way. If you had to pick for the men's side between the big five, between Federer, Nadal, Djokovic, and Murray, and Stan Wawrinka, or the field, which of those would you take?
That's a good question. I think I'd still take one of those five, yeah. I think among the other competitors, we've seen Milos Raonic, who had a nice top three run for a little bit. He seems to be suffering some injury issues. Nishikori, who's been within the top four or five for the last several months, has persistently struggled to get deep into tournaments. Stan has still been playing great, and he's one of those five. So, although I think it's unlikely he ends the year at number one, I wouldn't be tremendously surprised if Nadal, Federer, or Djokovic managed it. I think as exciting as it has been to see a new cohort kind of rise up among the young players, as far as 2017 goes, going to be one of those guys holding on to the number one spot by the end of the year. It's a little bit more of a toss-up on the women's side. Obviously, we've seen some vulnerability from Kerber, the current number one, Venus notching a nice win over her last week. So there tends to be a little bit more turnover in that top spot on the women's tour, and it'll be tough to predict. If I had to, I would not bet against Serena.
Hard to bet against Serena with all that she's accomplished and all that she's achieved in tennis, which is quite a lot. But as we said earlier, nice to see some of these familiar faces back at the top of the game winning and doing so well.
Yeah, it's been a great narrative for this year in sports.
My thanks again to Giddy Nathan, who covers all things tennis for the sports site Deadspin.com. I'm Andrew Palcheski in Washington, filling in for Sonny Young, and you're listening to The Sunny Side of Sports on The Voice of America.
The Voice of America, VOA.
Friends, we can all listen to The Sunny Side of Sports.
Yes, my friend.
Keep on the sunny side, always on the sunny side. Keep on the sunny side of life. It will help us every day. It will brighten all the way. It will keep on the sunny side of life.
Voice of America, VOA, Washington.
Hello! This is Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music.
Wake up, dance this music.
Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station, Saturdays and Sundays at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
Hi, this is Larry London, the host of VOA's Border Crossing. I feature music and interviews with your favorite artists from all around the world. And you can not only listen, but you can interact live with us here in Washington, D.C. Border Crossings comes to you Monday through Friday at 1500 UTC GMT on VOA.
The Voice of America.
Joining me now in the studio is my VOA colleague, Doug Bernard, who's here to talk about the latest trends in the sports world. Sporty greetings, Doug.
Sporty greetings, Andrew.
I understand the Olympics, Winter Olympics, are a little less than a year away, but already causing headlines on social media.
Already causing headlines and consternation to some degree. I think you could say that one of the hallmark sporting events of the Olympics is men's and women's hockey. It's always, you know, big audience viewership, that sort of thing. And just a few days ago, Gary Bettman, who's the NHL commissioner, announced that the NHL would not be sending players to the Olympics. They would not be participating. They will not take a two-week break as they have done in years past. And that's got a lot of people very upset. Now, first off, players among them, apparently Donald Fair, who is the players' union rep with the NHL, he never negotiated the 2018 Olympics because he said publicly, I just thought, of course, you know, the NHL is going to
it's
go.
It's a given.
It's
it
a
happens
given.
Every time.
Do you know, in fact, and this is true, that there are more people who watch hockey, professional hockey, in China than there are in the United States and Canada?
Really?
That is true. And
wow.
So that's, you know, it's a market of more than a billion people. Everybody was looking at South Korea as really a chance to kind of showcase some of the best about hockey. Well, at this point, the NHL says no go, but players and others are responding. Some people responding here on Twitter. Sean, let's see, what was the one here? Quisser Lodic, whoever that is, says, you know, I love the Olympics and all the tournaments, but the NHL isn't wrong here. And there are several people who are echoing that sentiment. not D.B. Godfrey, who says the Olympics, it's not the first time that Gary Bettman has put money ahead of love of the game. And some players responding, too, on Twitter. Alex Ovechkin saying, I won't say it in his tone, but you can just imagine him saying this. Somebody going to tell me I don't go. I don't care. I just go. Eric Carlson, the Ottawa Senators captain, has called the decision stupid. Henrik Lundqvist, the star goalie for the New York Rangers, saying it's a huge opportunity to market the game at the biggest stage is wasted, but most of all, disappointing for all the players that can't be a part of the most special adventure in sports. He should know. He himself has won Olympic gold for Team Sweden. So some fans and a lot of players very unhappy with the decision. They still may negotiate a way around this. But at this point, the NHL and all of their stars are a no-go for the South Korea Winter Olympics.
Yeah, surprise for many, but potentially an opportunity for some young players at the collegiate level to get in there and make their mark on the world stage.
Well, very much so. I mean, you think back to, you know, say the 1980 Winter Olympics that were held up in upstate New York, the so-called, you know, miracle team of 1980. Those weren't professional players. Those were, you know, young, literal amateur players. And of course, we've seen this in other Olympic sports, basketball, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, again, it like you say, it would be a good opportunity for some people, but maybe a missed opportunity for the NHL to market itself in Asia.
Yeah, and especially, as you mentioned, Henrik Lundqvist being from Sweden, Alex Ovechkin from Russia, mm-hmm. a real point of pride for NHL players, many of whom are international, to go home and play for their home team.
Absolutely, absolutely. And it's just, you know, Ovechkin has said this, others have said this, even though the Russian team has not been performing well the last several Olympics. It's just such a thrill to go back and play for your country. I can understand that. That makes a lot of sense to me. And as great as the Stanley Cup is, Olympic medaling has got to be pretty great too.
Yeah, you can only go for the gold once every 4 years.
Exactly.
So you got to make it count. What else is trending, Doug?
Well, it turns out that Florida Governor Jeb Bush, who did not do so well, in fact, did pretty terribly in last year's Republican presidential contest in the primaries. He's turned his eyes to a different game of sorts. It looks like he is saying that he may be interested in purchasing the Miami Marlins, baseball team. In some ways, if this were to happen, he would be following in the footsteps of his older brother, George W. Bush, who, of course, was a part owner in the Texas Rangers some time ago before selling that interest and going on to the White House. So we'll see. There's other names in the mix as well here. Daniel Kaplan, who follows professional baseball, saying he's not the only one. Derek Jeter is heading up a separate group and is in negotiations for making an offer as well. So that's kind of a odd pairing of people.
An interesting battle. Of course, Derek Jeter, the great Yankees player, number two, great player there. And Jeb Bush, following in his brother's footsteps. It'll be interesting to see. They say politics make strange bedfellows. Maybe sports do as well, having Jeter and Bush combine maybe to own this team. Very interesting.
And this may be something he has more success with than his more recent political exploits. Finally today, you may have heard that longtime Dallas Cowboys quarterback Tony Romo is retiring. He's been off and on. He's been plagued with injuries. Not only is he retiring, but he's moving on to the broadcast booth. He's going to cover games for CBS. And much in the way that the internet does, people are giving Tony a hard time. Here's Joe Prano on Twitter saying, "Can't say I'm surprised Tony Romo joined CBS. His role on the Cowboys last season was watching 60 Minutes."
Ouch. Not getting a lot of playtime with the Cowboys, Tony Romo was. But
no.
The joke may be on them because I think he's going to make a lot of money in that broadcasting gig.
Yeah.
Doug
More
Bernard.
Longevity, too.
Yes, Doug Bernard, thank you so much for joining me here. And that wraps up our April 6th edition of The Sunny Side of Sports. Thanks to Voice of America producer Bill Werkinger, VOA engineer Cornelius Tinner, and thank all of you for tuning in. I'm VOA's Andrew Palcheski in Washington, filling in for Sonny Young, and that's the sunny side of sports.
I get it.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
For nearly half a century, Zimbabwe has been dealing with the deadliest legacy of war, landmines. Between 1970 and 1980, during Zimbabwe's war for independence, hundreds of thousands, by some estimates even over a million of these indiscriminate killers, were sown along Zimbabwe's border with Mozambique to prevent cross-border raids into Zimbabwe by guerrilla fighters. By the time the war ended in 1980, Zimbabwe was peppered with very dense, unfenced minefields, about 240 linear kilometers of them. Even to this day, Zimbabwe is one of the most highly mine-impacted countries in the world, its danger zone booby-trapped with as many as 5,500 landmines per linear kilometer. Since 1980, more than 1,500 Zimbabwean people and 120,000 livestock have been killed in landmine accidents. Nonetheless, the need for arable land is so great in this area that farmers and pastorals have attempted to clear fields and pastures of landmines on their own. And still people die in landmine explosions, even as they go about their daily work. Over the years, the United States, along with numerous NGOs and governments, has sponsored mine clearance operations in Zimbabwe. Through the State Department's Office of Weapons Removal and Abatement, a part of the Bureau of Political Military Affairs, the United States government has provided more than $7.6 million for humanitarian demining in Zimbabwe just since 2012. One of the organizations sponsored by the United States for this work is the HALO Trust, a British-American nonprofit, non-governmental organization which removes war material in post-conflict areas. Under U.S. sponsorship, the HALO Trust is demining the minefields in northeastern Zimbabwe. Between 2013 and the end of 2015, the HALO Trust has removed over 10,000 landmines in Zimbabwe. And as the land is cleared of danger, the people move back to till and plant long-abandoned fields and to graze their cattle. They rebuild homes and cattle corrals. At last, they can collect firewood in the forest or water from a spring, take their produce to the market, and send their children to school without fear. In Zimbabwe, assistance from the United States has made a tangible difference in enabling local communities to successfully make a living on their own land.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Hello, I'm Douglas Impuga, host of Reporters Roundtable. Join me with a panel of journalists and analysts as we discuss Uganda becoming the home of the world's largest refugee camp. This Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
Are you suffering from heartache? No problem. We've got the cure for you. The African beat can soothe your heartache with its awesome tunes from the African continent. So join me, David Vandy, Mondays through Fridays at 0900 and 2000 Universal Time for a healing journey. I guarantee it.
Hello, Africa. This is James Barty, host of Daybreak Africa, inviting you to join me every weekday morning at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC as we bring you the latest in African news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of Daybreak Africa through our listener mail segment by sending your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. You can also call us and leave us a voicemail at 202-205-9942. That's 202-205-9942. And when you hear the Voice of America identification, press the number 25 to leave us your message. Start your day with Daybreak Africa every weekday morning at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC on the Voice of America.